is something very special from our friends at Oneida.
It is.
And Oneida's been in business how long?
Since 1880, David. 135 years.
They've been in this tabletop business a while.
Yes.
Yes.
Just a wee bit.
A little bit.
This clip comes from the QVC Shopping Network, and the salespeople are hawking Oneida brand silverware.
You don't stay in business for 30 minutes.
No.
If you're not delivering a product to the customer that does what you say it will do.
Exactly.
That will stand the test of time.
Yes.
Be durable, beautiful, and wonderful
yes.
on your tabletop.
On that, David, I've had my set for 29 years.
Is that
and
right?
I swear it looks as beautiful and bright and shiny today as it did the day I got it when I got married.
I think that clip nicely sums up the Oneida brand. Domesticity, weddings, marriage. Basically conformist middle-class values. These are the qualities associated with the Oneida silverware brand. And that branding was the brainchild of Pierpont Noyes, an ambitious and skilled young general manager who ran the company in the first part of the 20th century. And the QVC announcer is correct when she says that the Oneida Limited Company was formed in 1880. But actually, that's not the whole story. You see, for the first three decades of its existence, Oneida wasn't a corporation. Instead, it was a wildly creative and controversial experiment in communal living. The Oneida community lasted from 1848 until 1879. At its peak, over 300 people lived together as one family in a 93,000 square foot, gracious Italianate palace in central New York, about 30 miles from Syracuse. And their charismatic leader was a man named John Humphrey Noyes. So, yeah, his last name is spelled N-O-Y-E-S, which can be a little confusing in an audio podcast. And this community managed to flourish for decades while flouting nearly every convention of mainstream society, including norms about monogamy, marriage, and child rearing. Indeed, they were best known and most often criticized for their liberated women and their practice of free love. The irony of all this is that Pierpont Noyes, the man who fashioned Oneida's brand into a totem of conformist middle-class values, had grown up in the Oneida utopian commune under the most radical of circumstances. An anecdote from his autobiography gives a flavor of just how unorthodox Pierpont's upbringing was. This story he recounted took place in the mid-1870s, when Pierpont was about 5 years old. At that time, Oneida was a utopian commune, and Pierpont was a full-time resident of the Oneida Community Children's House. But Pierpont was no orphan. In fact, he lived in the same giant building, the Mansion House, as his mother, Harriet Warden. And his father, John Humphrey Noyes, was the founder of the Oneida Utopian Community. And it was young Pierpont's request to see his mother that caused him to run afoul of the superintendent of the children's house, the normally gentle Papa Kelly. When Papa Kelly explained to Pierpont that he was not permitted to see his mother more than the once weekly visit which the Oneida community allowed, Pierpont, in his words, promptly went berserk. I raged, I howled, I kicked, I laid down on the sink room floor and exhausted my infantile vocabulary in vehement protestations and accusations. But Papa Kelly was unmoved. He grabbed the boy and said, "Be still, Pip, be still. You have evidently got sticky to your mother. You may stay away from her another week." I'm Dan Greenstone, and this is the American Utopia Podcast. I hope you'll come with us as we do a deep dive into the Oneida community. And here's the thing. Even to this day, scholars and experts aren't quite sure what to make of Oneida.
Some amazing idealism occurred here that was acted out and achieved.
I obviously don't believe that the particular way that he thought Christian love should be expressed is workable or even desirable.
Was Oneida a grand and largely successful effort to radically rethink how we organize families, marriage, love, sex, and commerce? Or was it instead the twisted fantasy come to life of an incestuous, sex-obsessed cult leader? Oneida was the brainchild of John Humphrey Noyes, a a Christian perfectionist minister from Putney, Vermont. Noyes was able to gather a small group of committed followers, starting at first with his family and a few others who were attracted to his unconventional theology. And central to that theology was Noyes' insight that selfishness is the master sin. All of our bad instincts and behaviors, he believed, are generated by selfish drives. For this reason, they called their system Bible communism, which meant sharing all wealth and possessions. But what made them truly radical was that they extended this concept into human relations. Any overly strong human attachment or love for another person was regarded as selfish. This is why Papa Kelly cautioned young Pierpont that he had gotten sticky about his mother. And this prohibition against sticky love, or what they sometimes called special love, was the foundation for their practice of communal marriage, in which every adult was married to every adult of the opposite sex. In 1846, Noyes quietly inaugurated complex marriage among a select few of his devoted followers. But when word of their practices leaked out, Noyes was arrested for adultery. Fearing he'd be lynched by the outraged townspeople, in 1848, Noyes fled with most of his followers to Oneida Creek, New York. There, in the plains of central New York, Noyes and his followers were free to begin living communally in every way. And we'll have much more on Noyes later in this show and in future episodes. But for now, I think the best way to introduce the story is to focus on the remarkable life of Harriet Warden. She came to Oneida in 1849, when the community was still in its infancy, and Harriet herself was just 9 years old. Her grieving, widowed father sent Harriet, along with her siblings, to live at Oneida. At that time, in its green and immature stage, Oneida could sometimes get carried away with its own zeal. A good example of this is the so-called Doll Revolution, which took place at the Brooklyn Branch Satellite in 1851, when Harriet was 11. As one of the older kids at the commune, Harriet quickly became a leader, but that meant she was held to a very high standard of behavior by her elders. And though Harriet was a responsible child, when it came to playing with dolls, she fell short. Her friend Sarah Burt recalled, "Harriet and I were criticized for neglecting to come down to breakfast in time, and the reason why we did not was that we stopped to dress our dolls before dressing ourselves, and that made us late. Several times when we older girls were told at a certain time to come downstairs and wash and dress the little children, we forgot all about it because we were so taken up with our dolls." Did you hear when Sarah said that she and Harriet were criticized? Well, the Oneida Communards meant something very specific when they used the word criticism. Criticism was, in fact, a formal process at Oneida. On my visit to the Mansion House, I spoke with Anthony Wunderly, who was, for many years, the chief historian of the Mansion House Museum. And he's also the author of a new book on Oneida called Oneida Utopia, A Community Searching for Human Happiness and Prosperity. I asked him to explain how the Oneida Communards used what they called mutual criticism to regulate their community.
Mutual criticism was a technique in which typically one person would be addressed by a panel of perhaps 8 or 10 people facing that individual in a horseshoe. I mean, it was done different ways, but the most common way was in a small group environment like that. And one by one, each of the people in the panel, the interlocutors, would take turns telling the person what was wrong with him or her in terms of communal values, all of the person's weaknesses, defects, debilities, failures, in terms of communal values. So typically, over and over again, the things that they would zero in on were ego, selfishness, and selfish love, over and over and over again. And your job in receiving mutual criticism was to take it in. The rule was you had to keep your yap shut and listen, but you were free to disagree with an air of fact. So in other words, you were to sit there and take it in, and implicitly you were admitting that this was true and you needed to take account. And it was their way of holding each other's feet to the fire to expect the same high standards of behavior and thinking.
Do you think there were there some people who just couldn't do it? I mean, it sounds really challenging.
That was the most common way, the reason for seceding, for leaving the community. Couldn't take it.
While the panel of critics tried hard to praise, as well as criticize, the individual being examined, their illumination of a person's faults inevitably stung, and the variety of traits Oneida Communards could be criticized for was seemingly infinite, and covered the whole gamut, from the serious to the trivial to the absurd. There are records of criticisms for laughing too long or too loud, for having a pigeon-toed walk, and even for coughing too much. One man was told that his conversational style grated. He takes a position that you are not prepared for and announces it with such flat assurance that it gives you a jolt. Another young man was criticized for being overly dramatic. He talks for effect and walks for effect. He flourishes his handkerchief for effect, takes out his letters and watch for effect. One young woman was criticized for the way she called attention to her foot, as though it was very pretty and she wanted others to notice it. People were criticized for being messy, for being bad at sex, for dancing too poorly, and even for dancing too well. By nearly all accounts, mutual criticism could indeed be grueling. One community member described the process this way: "Every trait of my character that I took any pride or comfort in seemed to be cruelly discounted, and after, as it were, being turned inside out and thoroughly inspected, I was, metaphorically, stood upon my head and allowed to drain till all the self-righteousness dripped out of me." Another woman said that after being criticized, she would go away by myself to take thought and cry a little. As for John Humphrey Noyes, Oneida's founder and leader, he never sat for criticism, though he did say that if Jesus or St. Paul were to return to earth, he'd be willing to do it. The theme that unified all criticisms was selfishness, the master sin in John Humphrey Noyes' theology. But there were different brands of selfishness, and it was a very particular kind of selfishness that landed Harriet Warden and her friend Sarah Burt in trouble over the dolls. Oneida was particularly concerned with stamping out excessive love of one's own children. Molly Jessup is a curator at the Oneida Mansion House Museum, and on my visit there, I asked her to explain this dynamic to me.
So, in mainstream American society, in the 1800s, being a mother is really viewed as one of the most important things that will happen to a woman in her lifetime and one of her most important responsibilities. The perfectionists actually downplayed motherhood and its importance, and that was for several reasons. One of those was to avoid selfishness. So they wanted parents to love all children equally, and to not was to have the sin of philoprogenitiveness. Philoprogenitiveness, which would mean favoring your child over other children.
Indeed, Mary Cragen, an early Oneida convert who was in charge of the children's wing at the time, was so bothered by the effect of the dolls on Harriet and the other girls that she determined to be done with them once and for all. She initiated a debate amongst the children about the immorality of the dolls. In the end, after several long speeches and much deliberation, Harriet, like each of the other boys and girls, voted to burn all of the wax dolls. While the vote was technically unanimous, the surviving documents indicate that, like many of the other decisions undertaken at the Oneida community, this apparent unanimity masked significant ambivalence. One witness described the decision this way: "There was but one vote in the matter. The little boys were loud in their clamors for the great massacre, and the little girls, after a few struggles, were ready to make sacrifice of their idols." Harriet Warden recorded what happened next. "We all formed a circle round the large stove, each girl carrying on her arm her long-cherished favorite and marching in time to a song. We came opposite the stove door. We threw our dolls into the angry-looking flames and saw them perish before our eyes." Mary Cragen remembered the same incident more fondly. "The dolls," she wrote, "were laid on the coals and burned up with a merry blaze, and all hands rejoiced in their condemnation." The doll revolution may make Oneida seem like a grim and joyless place, And while it was quite zealous in its early years, it did loosen up over time. And the Children's House was, for the most part, a lively and fun place to live, perhaps akin to a humanely run boarding school. In her memoir, Harriet Warden recalled one such fun evening. Mr. Noyes proposed an entertainment for the children. So, a nice supper consisting of bread, butter, frosted cakes, nuts, raisins, was gotten up, and a long table was set up in the upper sitting room. Many busy hands prepared it, so that at the return of the bathers, all was ready. At the appointed time, the little ones were brought over. It was a surprise, evidently, from the exclamations of, "Oh, oh," as they saw so generous a display. They were soon seated and ate their supper while nearly the whole family were looking on. The corridor was crowded. Father Noyes looked on approvingly. It was a beautiful sight, and all the children behaved beautifully. The Communards even found ways to make their Bible study fun. They invented a game that's a little bit reminiscent of a modern game show. Warden described it this way. "We arranged ourselves in a circle, forming a class, as in school. Two or three of the best readers were appointed to take turns in the office of master. The master opened the testament at random, with the point of a knife, and reading the first verse that met his eye, called on the head of the class to tell what book it was in. If the answer was correct, the master said right, and opened again, and put a new verse to the next in class. If the answer was not right, he said, the next, and so on until the answer was correct." Warden recalled that John Humphrey Noyes was always the best player. Indeed, he seems to have had a towering intellect. She remembered, "Mr. Noyes seldom failed to give at once the book, chapter, and verse of the passage read, and to indicate its locality in the polyglot Bible he had always used. While we were often astonished at his wonderful memory of the Bible, it incited us to renewed perseverance in acquainting ourselves with the same." By the mid-1850s, when she was in her mid-teens, Harriet and many of her peers graduated from the Children's House and joined the adult community at Oneida. Here's how she described this transition in her memoir. "Immediately after the admission of this class to the Society of Adults, they were placed under the particular care of individuals selected by the community. They were at the same time distributed round to the various departments of business. The boys finding employment in the shops, on the farm, and in the garden. The girls in the kitchen, laundry, and printing office. Most of the boys continued their attendance at the school, while the girls pursued their studies under special instructors, or attended the various evening classes. While that division of labor by gender may sound quite traditional by our contemporary standards, Oneida was a radically liberating place for women in the 19th century. Communal child-rearing, of course, spared women much of the isolation and drudgery that mothers outside the community faced daily. And Oneida also allowed for frequent job rotation, which provided more variety, especially since men often joined in to help with traditional women's work. And the communal nature of work could often greatly enliven otherwise dull tasks. Harriet Warden recalled the satisfaction she and others found in the many work bees that the community held. Here's her description of a washing bee. "Ah, our old washing days, the whole scene comes up before me as I write. The room is brightly lighted, the tubs filled with water, and every preparation made for the morning's event. An odor of soap suds emanating from two large cauldrons of boiling clothes fills the atmosphere. One by one, the washers come in, some looking rather sleepy, others wide awake for the work. A few of the men are discussing the latest political news, another group are absorbed in topics nearer home, others are rehearsing, with comments of their own, the play enacted the previous Saturday evening. Anon, the whole group are formed into a grand musical chorus, now singing snatches of an old anthem, and now divided into sections. The air is soon resonant with such rounds as Scotland's Burning, Merrily, Merrily Greet the Morn, or Glide Along My Bonny Boat. Tired, and before another song can be produced, the breakfast bell sounds, announcing to the astonished company that they have washed an hour and a half. A fine pile of clothes in yonder box, looking spotlessly white, proves that the time has not been squandered." Oneida community women were also pioneers when it came to replacing the confining corsets and hoop skirts that were fashionable in Victorian America with a more practical and comfortable style of clothing that historians call dress reform. Here's how Harriet Warden described the inauguration of this experiment in her memoir. During the summer, some new ideas had been broached on the subject of women's dress, and Mr. Noyes made the following remark. Women's dress is a standing lie. It proclaims that she is not a two-legged animal, but something like a churn standing on casters. And so, after various experiments and many contrivings, Warden went on to say, Oneida women made short dresses of their long ones, and made pantalettes to correspond. They tried them on, and were almost frightened at themselves. Had they the courage to wear them? This innovation upon worldly fashions was entirely original with them, and in adopting it, they might be considered bold and unfeminine. But conscious of a right motive, they resolved to don the new suit and take the consequences. Their first appearance took the family by surprise, and, as they had apprehended, produced a sensation. To some, they looked exceedingly comical. A number of the women were very much shocked. Others declared the new costume ridiculous and absurd, and a few were greatly distressed. But the voice of the majority commended their trim appearance, and after the first surprise, most of the family were delighted with the change. As bustling and productive as the workday could be, the nights at Oneida were even livelier. In her memoir, Harriet Warden listed a typical week's schedule of evening activities. Monday, reading and report of newspaper. Tuesday, lecture on social topics. Wednesday, exercises in phonography. Thursday, music, vocal, and instrumental. Friday, dancing. Saturday, reading perfectionist publications. And Sunday, Bible class. And it was music and drama that proved to be Harriet Warden's special gift and passion. I sang simply because I loved to sing, she recalled. It was the greatest pleasure I knew. I was full of enthusiasm to study music and sought every opportunity to improve myself. And as a gifted piano player, Harriet quite often provided accompaniment for the community's many dances, which included squares, waltzes, and Virginia reels. She also played the piccolo in the community orchestra. And in spite of the fact that he was widely regarded as a terrible musician, John Humphrey Noyes was second violin. The Oneida community also put on countless plays and musical theater productions, including Gilbert and Sullivan's HMS Pinafore. Harriet was frequently cast in choice parts. She was Jessica in Merchant of Venice, and she had a key role in an elaborate cantata that the community choir rehearsed for months before giving several widely praised performances. Harriet was not just a talented musician, she was also a wonderful writer. And in 1873, when she was in her early 30s, she was appointed editor of the Circular, the Oneida community's newspaper. It's clear that Harriet's father's decision to send her to Oneida opened up horizons for her that were simply unimaginable for most 19th century women. Christian Goodwillie is an expert on intentional communities and the director of special collections at Hamilton College. And I spoke with him about the place of women at Oneida.
You know, one other comment about women at the Oneida community, besides obviously the aspects of dress reform, of sexual liberation, of opportunities to do the kind of manual labor that if they wanted to, you know, a lot of women in the world weren't doing, such as they worked in the trap shop and things. But the editorial role of, I believe it was Harriet Warden, with their publications is really notable. You know, I mean, there's very few other 19th century women that are editing publications. So for the Oneida community to give women that avenue for expression, I think is further proof of the importance of their role here.
It's obvious from her memoir that Harriet Warden's life at Oneida was in many ways incredibly vibrant and full. She summed up her experiences this way. As I daily pass the site of the old mansion house, my thoughts involuntarily revert to the time when we were all snugly housed in the old building, and many a scene dances before my mind, which is long laid buried in the past. I see again those companions whom I so early learned to love. I see the kind guardians and parents who so anxiously watched over our every interest. I recall the dreams of childhood, the fond hopes and aspirations of youth, the deeper affections and binding friendships of maturer years, and I live once more in the past. The dances, the songs, the dramas, the games are all curiously associated and intermixed with an undercurrent of stern experience, in which mind and heart were chastened and character deepened and molded. Many of her fellow communards seemed to share Harriet's glowing view of life at Oneida. Indeed, most of the Oneida memoirs have a similar nostalgic glow. But one of the things that's jarring about the commune is the disconnect between the positive self-presentation of Oneida and the dystopian way it was viewed by outsiders. A reporter for the New York Times visited Oneida in 1878 and sent back a scornful and contemptuous account of what he saw there. As the carriage turned the entrance gate and came into view, he wrote, "I saw a withered figure bend over an open rose and kiss it with a pathetic tenderness. Her face was pale and somewhat haggard, and there were dark shadows beneath her eyes. She wore a faded calico skirt that descended but a trifle below the knee. Turkish trousers completed the costume. It was a sorry and ridiculous figure, and the uncomeliest outfit that a woman in full possession of her senses ever put on. Numerous other figures flitted awkwardly about, carrying such wan, pathetic faces as to furnish an argument in advance against socialism." The New York Times reporter was clearly uncomfortable with the way Oneida shattered traditional gender roles and broke taboos. And it's tempting to chalk up this contempt to 19th century puritanical prejudice. But I think it's more complicated than that. Harriet Warden's memoir is entirely silent on perhaps the most important part of life at the Oneida community, sex. And as in so many other ways, sexual life for women at Oneida was extremely unusual. Molly Jessup is a curator at the Oneida Community Mansion House Museum, and I spoke with her about this aspect of community life. I started by asking her about male continence, the remarkably effective birth control method that was invented by John Humphrey Noyes, the community's founder. I interviewed Molly in the Great Hall of the Mansion House, where Harriet Warden's concerts and plays were performed, which was really cool. But the acoustics are just a bit echoey.
So male continence is the community's form of birth control. So in this community, although they practiced complex marriage, they had a pretty low birth rate for the first 20 or so years because of this practice of male continence. So basically, men are supposed to stop themselves before reaching climax. And the community metaphor for this that John Humphrey Noyes wrote in the male continence pamphlet is... the skillful oarsman knows whether to stand still water, venture down the rapids, or go over the falls, and one would not want to go over the falls.
We're near Niagara Falls here, right?
Right, yeah. So maybe this is...
top of mind.
Yeah, yeah. So this is their practice, and if you read the male continence pamphlet, you can see that he mentions sort of the physical and emotional toll that pregnancy can take on women, and... he uses some of that as one of the reasons that men might be the ones responsible for birth control. But you really see, too, that for them this is also reflects that sex was a spiritual thing, too. So it wasn't just about that physical pleasure and release. There was also trying to reach, like, the greater plane of spirituality.
So male continence sounds like something that might take some practice.
They believed in something called ascending fellowship. So in ascending fellowship, the basic idea is that the older you are, the more advanced you are in your spiritual perfection. So in terms of their sexual relationships, they would have wanted younger people to be partnered with older people so that the older people could impart their spiritual wisdom to the younger people through intimate association. So in practice, what this means is that, you know, when a young man is just starting out and is in entering into complex marriage, he might be paired with an older woman who's closer to menopause, less likely to become pregnant, until he really masters the form of birth control, and vice versa, young women and older men.
Anthony Wunderly may be the most sanguine and positive about the Oneida experience of any of the experts I talked to. And while he didn't really defend ascending fellowship, he did try to put it in context for me.
Early on, the Oneida community made a commitment to initiate its own people into its own culture, into its own way of living. And of course, that is troubling because it includes sex. Sex was a large part of the Oneida community. The idea that you should initiate your own in a loving way into your way of life without trying to shield them as much as possible from the storms of the world. I don't know about you, but my first sex was not a particularly happy experience, nor was it for many people I know, and I'm 68. They are confusing times when when all kinds of chemical bombs are going off in your mind and you are ill at ease with the world and you have little self-confidence and you don't know who you are. And the Oneida community notion of initiating youngsters into sex was that we will help you out with that in a kind, loving fashion, bringing you into the family without that kind of confusion and pain. You're being silent. I guess you're admitting to nothing, but
no, I hear what you're saying.
But my point is, in my life, teenage sex and first sex and early sex and all the stuff that goes into romance is something that just consumes your life and your emotion and your passions. And to call it a happy experience, I wonder, was it for you?
Let's not forward the tapes of it to the Sex Hall of Fame. How about that?
Okay. That was the idea, and that was enunciated explicitly early on, and it was part of Ascending Fellowship. The way it worked, apparently, we don't know much about this, but apparently the way it worked is that older women would initiate younger boys going through puberty and train them in male continence, in the ability to have sex without reaching climax. And then they would be vetted, in effect, by older women and then released into the complex marriage system of the whole. For girls, when they reach puberty, the most common pattern was that John Noyes would initiate them, as you say, his first husband. That is offensive, and it's like an old medieval custom of the medieval lord deflowering the young women on his manor or whatever. They were always open about that. And the reasons were, as I've just tried to explain to you, whether or not you think they're good or bad, they believed that they had reasons to do that. And Noyes was the person in their way of thinking best qualified to do that because he was near as God. He was at the top of Ascending Fellowship. He was perfect.
And so it would have been John Humphrey Noyes who introduced Harriet Warden into the sexual life of the community. Of course, even before this, Noyes would have been a central figure in young Harriet's life. It was Noyes who agreed to take her into his community after the loss of her mother at age 9. It was Noyes who was regarded as a living saint by all the community members. And like the other community members, adults as well as children, Harriet Warden would have referred to him as Father Noyes. Harriet's memoir is silent on this issue, and in fact, on anything at all to do with sex. And so one can only imagine the complex stew of emotion she must have felt as Noyes took on the role of what the communards called first husband. I asked Molly Jessup if the decision to enter complex marriage was really a free choice on the part of girls like Harriet.
So I'm not really sure what the answer would be on that, but I imagine there might be pressure depending on who someone is in the community who's requesting a social interview. It might be more difficult to turn them down.
For example, John Humphrey Noyes.
Right, yeah. So perhaps just depending on someone's leadership position, it would be difficult to say no. But we don't have records on that.
How about in terms of age of consent, or if that was even a thing?
Yeah, so in the 1870s is where you're first starting to see these large-scale conversations in the United States about the age of consent. The age of consent in New York State in the 1800s was 12.
12?
Yeah. But that's not the lowest. The lowest in the United States was Delaware, which was 7 years old.
Seven?
Yeah. But
Delaware.
Sure, yeah. So, but if you, like, you know, if you introduce people, oh, this is my 8-year-old wife, people would probably, that would be pretty socially unacceptable, I think. So in this community, it sounds like young men and women were brought into complex marriage at about puberty age, let's say. So that is younger than what we in our modern time would think of as the appropriate age for consent. It might be something closer to 14 years old rather than 18. And there's also some outlier cases where people might have been younger than that. But again, it's difficult to know because those records don't exist.
And Harriet Warden's relationship with John Humphrey Noyes only grew more complicated in 1869 when the community undertook an extraordinary decision to begin a eugenics program that they called stirpiculture. Molly Jessup explains.
In 1869, the community decided that they were financially stable enough to have children, and they were motivated to have children by a strong interest in science. After reading different things about evolution and heredity, they were hoping that spirituality was a trait that could be genetically transmitted, and that as a religious community, maybe the children that were born here would have a greater spirituality from the outset and then be able to benefit mankind with their goodness. So the community asked for volunteers, and there were about 41 women and 40 men who volunteered to be parents. And these potential parents were assessed for their spirituality. And then if people seemed to be spiritually strong, they might be selected to be parents.
In her memoir, Harriet Warden described the very public decision-making process that determined who got to have children with whom. The discussion for this evening's meeting was stirpiculture. Mr. Woolworth and Mr. Hamilton introduced the subject very delicately, and at last ventured to announce that Mr. Noyes had expressed a desire that John Lord might become a father. As to the mother, it was proposed to decide that by vote. So, a bit of paper was handed round, and after each one had written thereon a name, they were recalled and counted. It was then announced that for Miss Georgiana Sears, there were 87 votes. Loud cheering. John and Georgiana each expressed their thankfulness to follow the wishes of the community in this matter, and the meeting closed. It was a credit to her sterling reputation in the community that Harriet Warden was one of 9 women selected to have a child with John Humphrey Noyes. And the fact that she had 2 other children with 2 different men shows in what high esteem she was held in the community. Harriet Warden was by nature a loving and affectionate mother. But of course, these tendencies ran contrary to Oneida's theology. John Humphrey Noyes taught that any strong attachment, whether romantic or maternal, was regarded as tantamount to committing the sin that the communards called special or sticky love. It had been her son Pierpont who had thrown the tantrum when Papa Kelly kept them apart. But Harriet suffered from the separation between the two of them at least as much. In his memoir, Pierpont remembered the bittersweet emotions that Harriet felt at his 6th birthday party. My mother was allowed to arrange a birthday party for me. I remember 2 little chairs and a low table set out under the tulip tree in the quadrangle. There were only 2 at the party, Dick and I, but it was a real party and we had cake. I think my mother got even more pleasure than I did. The community system was harder on mothers than on their children. Whenever I was permitted to visit my mother in her mansard room, she always lavished affection on me until, much as I loved her, I half grudged the time taken from play with those toys which she had collected for my benefit. Still, Pierpont was always sad when he had to leave his mother. Certain it is that I often wept bitterly when the time came to return to the children's house, he recalled. I remember my mother's terror, lest my crying be heard. She knew that Father Noyes frowned on any excess of parental affection, as he did on all forms of special love, and she feared that such demonstrations might deprive her of some of my regular visits. This constant uncertainty filled Harriet with anxieties and insecurities. Pierpont remembered that when he played on the floor, his mother would bend over him, her dark eyes appealing, and asked me, "Darling, do you love me?" My marbles and blocks were forgotten, I would reach up and put my arms around her neck. And I remember how tightly she held me and how long, as though she would never let me go. But of course, as Pierpont grew older and gained more independence, Harriet saw even less of him. And as he gradually began to engage with the world outside of the mansion house, he found that his unusual background attracted unwelcome attention. The extremely unorthodox web of parenting at Oneida only further alienated outsiders. The community had always had a complicated relationship with its nearest neighbors. By the mid-1850s, Oneida had gained a solid financial footing, primarily due to the demand for the animal traps they manufactured. This success supported the community's lavish lifestyle and allowed the community to hire local laborers to work in its factory. And yet, while these workers were grateful for their jobs, they also resented the wealth and the holier-than-thou attitude of their employers. When he was 7, Harriet Warden's son Pierpont got his first taste of this jealousy when he was returning back to the community from a visit to the trap factory on Turkey Street. Here's how he recounts the event in his autobiography. "We were walking toward home, feeling rather pleased with ourselves, because Jack McQuaid, the burly Irish foreman with the red shoebrush mustache and tobacco juice oozing from both corners of his mouth, had taken pains to show us all the machines and processes of trap making. We had not gone far when a loud yelling attracted our attention. Looking back, we saw a mob of Turkey Street boys running down the road toward us, their actions suggesting hostile intent. When they came nearer, they jeered, called us Christ boys and bastards. One little boy, wearing a cap so big that it covered much of his dirty face, ran in front of us and dared us to fight. We were disconcerted. Community boys were forbidden even to speak to outside boys. And here were the lowest specimens of the species, bent on forcing us to more forbidden actions. An older boy called Tom grabbed my arm and thrust his face in front of me. He sneered, 'God damn goody community boys.'" Pierpont's sense of superiority over his neighbors was not to last long. Just 3 years later, when he was 10, the community dissolved. The reasons that the community voted to disband itself are fascinating, and we'll delve into them in a later episode. I asked Molly Jessup to explain what effect the dissolution of the community had on the children who were born as part of their eugenics experiment.
When the community disbanded, a lot of them went with their biological mothers, who married the biological father of their child. There were some cases where that was not a possibility. So Harriet Warden, for instance, had 3 children, 3 different fathers, which wasn't a problem in the community. But when the community was disbanding, there was no one available for her to marry, and then she was a single mother raising 3 children, which you can imagine would have been very challenging in the 1800s.
Is there any record or details of how that was a challenge that you can recall?
The fact that she had to, for instance, work in the factory when her sister was able to marry a former community member and, you know, later was like traveling through Europe and things like that.
While Harriet's sister was able to maintain most of her wealth and status, Harriet and her 3 kids were forced to move to Turkey Street, the very neighborhood where Pierpont had been bullied. In a report to the community about the Doll Revolution, Mary Cragen wrote this: "The children that have followed have never had dolls. Some of them have never seen any, and we opine they are all better for it." Next time on American Utopia, we tell the story of how a painfully shy boy turned himself into a religious and sexual revolutionary and convinced himself and others that he was perfect.